Once at a gathering of ministers, the topic of first sermons came up. One of the colleagues asked, "When you got to your current church, what was the first topic that you preached on?" Now most of us spoke about our religious journeys or perhaps our callings to ministry, something to tell a bit about ourselves. And then one of the colleagues said, "I preached on death." Heads began shaking. Ministers looked around each other. "Death? For your first sermon?" My colleague then went on to speak about how we live in a death-denying culture and people just don't speak on death enough. And he said that he wanted his congregation to feel comfortable coming to speak with him about anything. And so by talking about death, that was a way of opening it up. It was also a way of addressing the criticism that Unitarian Universalists have no theology of suffering and that we can come across as superficial or the sunny side up religion. Now, usually when I perform memorial services, I mention that our lives are like a portrait. And if you take the canvas, our days upon the earth are the interactions that we have with one another, very little dabs of paint, or sometimes the thick textures of paint that go onto that canvas. But the frame around the portrait is death. Everything that takes place during the course of our lives is on the canvas. But the frame is the reminder that there's nothing beyond that. In later years, I knew several colleagues who wrote and preached extensively on death while they were suffering and dealing with their terminal illnesses. My first wife's death will always be a touchstone in my preaching. However, while she was dying, she forbade me from addressing the topic. And so for nearly 7 years, I didn't speak about death in the pulpit. Now, for the first couple of years after her death, I probably spoke about death a lot more than anyone wanted to hear. Recently, after watching Dr. Atul Gawande, whose book, Being Mortal, was turned into a PBS documentary, I decided to read the book. Gawande explores territory similar to Philip Simmons, whose Learn to Fall focused on his experience with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Both Gawande and Simmons address the question of how to find some quality of life when you realize that your physical and or your mental powers are diminishing. Depending on any number of factors, this could be when we're 20 or 30. I expect that by the time most of us reach the age of 40, we realize that we're not going to be candidates for Rookie of the Year in any major sports. And most of us realize that we'll never again have that youthful physical prowess that we might have once had. This would be one of the reasons why professional athletes are, for the most part, in their 20s, some continue into their 30s, and a very, very select few continue on in their 40s. Now, professional athletes are not alone in this. I've read that nearly all of the Nobel Prize laureates for mathematics did their work before they were 40 years old. Now, who could have thought that professional athletes and mathematicians would have so much in common? Now, of course, there are good things to be said for getting older. Hopefully, the added years will have brought insights into life, if not wisdom, gleaned from our experiences. I'd like to think that I'm a better minister now than I was at 31 and in my first parish. I expect that many of you have similar things to say about your professional skills. And I'd also like to think that I'm a better parent and a better spouse, too. There's something to be said for age and wisdom. And perhaps it's one of the reasons why elders are revered in so many cultures. When I see my hearing specialist, who I have known for more than 50 years, it's usually a couple of days after I've run the half marathon in Philadelphia. My goal each year is to be as close as possible to the previous year's time. And once in a while, I'll even beat the previous year's time, and I feel as though I'm pushing it back against the mean, villain of aging. When my friend asks me how I think I'm doing physically, I tell him, I passed my annual physical on the streets of Philadelphia. And then he tells me how close I am to the previous year's hearing test. And again, if he tells me it's the same, I feel as though I've had a victory. I know that I will never hear as well as I did when I was younger. But if I can maintain and stay as close as possible, then I feel as though it's a moral victory. In their own ways, the half marathon and the hearing test are reminders of my diminishing powers as well as mortality. In his foreword to Learning to Fall, Philip Simmons writes, "We deal most fruitfully with loss by accepting the fact that we will one day lose everything. When we learn to fall, we learn that only by letting go our grip on all that we ordinarily find most precious, our achievements, our plans, our loved ones, our very selves, can we find ultimately the most profound freedom. In the act of letting go of our lives, we return more fully to them." That's an amazing insight. Knowing that you have, are, or will be losing something makes it all the more precious. Think about things that you have lost in your lives. A job, a friendship, any other relationship. I wish that every couple I marry could take that into consideration on the day that they wed and wake up each day and remind themselves just how precious that relationship is. Unfortunately, most people give little thought to these things until they suffer losses. Usually it's too late to do anything. It may resemble the feeling of being in a skidding car as you're heading toward another car, or a tree, or even a person. We live in a death-denying culture. It can be terrifying to accept our losses. Atul Gawande was moved to write, "Dying and death confront every new doctor and nurse. The first times, some cry, some shut down, some hardly notice. I was too guarded to cry, but I dreamt about them. I had recurring nightmares in which I'd find my patients' corpses in my house, even in my bed." Death, of course, is not a failure. Death is normal. Death may be the enemy, but it is also the natural order of things. Now, in talking to people, it's not death itself that seems to be most frightening. It's the process of dying. As Woody Allen has said, "I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens." Philip Simmons writes, "You might say that I want my eternal life now, before it's over." My friend and colleague, Kit Howe, who died of lung cancer in 1996, would say, "I can't imagine a world without me in it." And I said to him, "Me neither." And so we embraced, and then he died several weeks later. From their different perspectives, Philip Simmons as a dying writer and Atul Gawande as a surgeon who has dealt with dying people address this issue. Philip Simmons was 35 when he was first diagnosed with ALS. While most people die within 5 years, he lived for 10. Eventually, he had to stop teaching at Lake Forest College outside Chicago and move with his family to a small town in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. He spent childhood summers there, and his parents had retired to the town. When he could no longer climb the mountains that had meant so much to him in his youth, he rejoiced as his wife and one of his sons went to climb Mount Washington while he watched on the web from a camera mounted on the observatory at the summit. Sometimes we receive these lessons in mortality from life experiences. 35 years ago, when I was doing my hospital chaplaincy, I was assigned to the orthopedic and the surgical wards. I joked that my patients were either chopped up or broken up. The patients who were sent to physical therapy would tell me about the challenging workouts that they had to go through every day. In later years, I would visit parishioners who were going through various forms of physical therapy, and sometimes I would accompany them to their sessions and cheer them on. My respect for their efforts grew enormously when, in 2001, I herniated a couple of discs while cross-country skiing. I thought cross-country skiing was supposed to be a low-impact, non-injury sport until I took a tumble. The result was a first-hand experience with lengthy physical therapy. I learned that there were some activities that I would never again do, and there were others that I would be able to return to, as long as I put in the time and effort and the physical therapy worked, because I know that it doesn't always work. So the skiing equipment will remain in the garage until one of my sons takes it with him. It's helpful having three of us who are right around the same height and same shoe size. Now, two of the biggest fears that people have as they age are that of being excluded from activities that they enjoy doing, and that of being alone. My brother loved going out for long bike rides and participating in annual fundraising rides for charities. After he suffered a stroke that severely debilitated him when he was 57, he realized that his days of hopping on his bicycle to ride 25 or 50 miles or more were over. Another consequence of the stroke was that he moved into our mother's condominium because there's an elevator and there are no steps to climb. Now, that's one of the reasons why I'm having to spend so much more time in Philadelphia. I'm the physical witness, the person who has to make the decisions for both of them. So whenever I go to Philadelphia to run in a race, I take the finisher medal that they always hand out, which I really consider just a tchotchke, as they would say, or a trinket, but it means little to me. I take it to the condo, and I put it around his neck. And often, I take him out for coffee or lunch, and people look at him, and I say, look, what you are going through every day with your physical therapy is much tougher than the workouts that I have to put in to run a half marathon. The experiences of a wife dying and a brother suffering from a debilitating stroke that ended his career as a clinical physician have made me attentive to both the preciousness of life as well as its fragility. It's made me grateful for my own comparatively good health. While I do not hear concerts as well as I would like, at least I can go home and crank up a stereo or get into the car when nobody else is sitting there with me, as I do for my long rides, and turn up the stereo as loud as I need to, and enjoy it. Technology does have its benefits. Atul Gawande writes, being mortal is about the struggle to cope with the constraints of our biology with limits set by genes and cells and flesh and bone. Medical science has given us remarkable power to push against these limits, and the potential value of this power was a central reason I became a doctor. But again and again, I've seen the damage we in medicine do when we fail to acknowledge that such power is finite and always will be. We've been wrong about what our job is in medicine. We think our job is to ensure health and survival. But really, it's larger than that. It is to enable well-being. Later he tells us, if to be human is to be limited, then the role of caring professions and institutions, from surgeons to nursing homes, ought to be aiding people in their struggle with those limits. Sometimes we can offer a cure, sometimes only a salve, sometimes not even that. Whatever we can offer, our interventions and the risks and sacrifices they entail are justified only if they serve the larger aims of a person's life. So all the help, all the work that medicine can provide, it's justified only if they serve the larger aims of a person's life. One of the consequences of living in our age is that medicine can do wonderful things. In the future, even more so-called miracles will happen. I can put a high-priced amplifier in my ear to enable me to hear a bit more. Thanks to Ben Franklin, that most fertile of human minds, many of us can wear bifocals to see objects that would have been too close to see clearly, and enabling us to continue reading, as well as being able to see in the distance. Furthermore, if we choose to spend the money, we can have a laser shape the lens of our eyes so that we don't even need to wear glasses or contact lenses for most things. I think of these as advances in what I'll call mundane medicine. I call it mundane medicine because it has to do with our daily lives, just getting around, just living in the everyday. Another category would be the advances of what I call heroic medicine. I call it heroic because it can literally rescue us from death and save our lives. Some of the advances are just astonishing when we look at it. They would have been unthinkable a century or even 75 or even 50 years ago in some cases. Most obvious example would be the organ donor cards that I hope most of us, if not all of us, carry around. Our bodies are veritable recycling bins. It's amazing. Our bodies can help another person to live. Another person may see if they receive our eyes. They help with hearts, pancreases, kidneys, livers. All these can be transplanted into another body. So when we die, our organs continue living on in the life everlasting. Advances have been so remarkable that even a face can be transplanted onto another skull. Atul Gawande is a surgeon who is very knowledgeable about these advances. However, he's also warning us that there are limits to what should be done. And sometimes the cures can be worse than the cancers or other illnesses that they're being used to treat. For those of us who advocate what is called death with dignity, he offers a cautionary note by pointing out that half of the people who obtain the necessary prescriptions to end their lives don't use them. It's merely the fact that they're able to obtain them that gives them courage to go on. It gives them a sense of meaning and purpose. That's why he speaks about the importance of personal well-being. In essence, what is best for the patient in his or her situation? He writes, our ultimate goal, after all, is not a good death, but a good life to the very end. the image of a good life to the very end is, of course, a relative term. I think of a child in one of my congregations who was born with such severe problems that on the night of his birth, he was airlifted to another hospital where they were better equipped to deal with his affliction. That he lived into his teenage years was a miracle. His life was filled with constant rushes to the hospital. However, I know that he was loved by his mother, his father, and his two stepbrothers. I expect that many of us know others whose lives were filled with physical or emotional pain and suffering, but who found meaning and hope, knowing that their lives mattered. This is where we get into the theological aspects of life as a terminal condition. All of us know that we will one day die. As Jim Morrison said, nobody gets out of life alive. It comes from recognizing and accepting the reality that our lives are constantly winding down as we learn to fall, as Philip Simmons writes. And our prayers are to do as much as we can and to touch the lives of others and to make an impression before the clock runs out. As a minister, I speak about death because it's the natural and inevitable final stage of the life cycle. It's the frame that sets the boundaries for our lives. The Buddhists are onto something when they speak about impermanence. As much as we would like to go on living, like my friend Kit Hale, who could not imagine a world without him in it, all of us know that we will eventually die. There's a difference between accepting death and worshiping it. That's why ours is a religion that does accept death, but it also affirms life at every stage. So be it.